Well, good morning, and welcome to another edition of Mornings for the Master.
Certainly glad to have each of you here today. My name is Chip Horton, and we'll be beginning here shortly with the book of Exodus. We're certainly thankful to be able to open up God's Word and study together as we have the opportunity even today to jump into another portion of Scriptures that we're blessed to be able to read together. And hope that you'll join in that chat window already with us this morning. We see that Miss Ann is here, and we see Jody's there, and Brother Chris is in there already this morning. And so Ryan and I will be able to jump in there and begin that study even momentarily. But we look at those things that are before us on the bulletin board. And we start with the big event here in Mount Vernon this weekend, the fourth annual Make Me a Servant Workshop. Certainly kicks off Friday night with emphasis for the youth, but all are invited. Michael Light is coming to kick off our Rekindling the Fire series with Light the Fire. How appropriate. And then Saturday, as early as 10 a.m., we'll start out with our lessons, beginning with Clay Bond and Rekindling the Fire for Personal Study. And then classes will continue throughout the day for both men and ladies. We'll have a great lunch. Looking forward to baked potatoes and brisket being served at the 12 o'clock hour. And then men's and ladies' classes will resume, and we'll be back together at 3 o'clock with John McCormack together in a joint assembly as we look at the idea of rekindling the fire for personal evangelism. And so if you can be with us, certainly plan to be here Friday night at 7 o'clock. Come a little early and fellowship with us and get ready to hear Michael Light. But if you can't make that, we understand, but make sure and be here on Saturday, February the 4th at 10 o'clock. Is that going to be on the web here? Is that going to be archived? Or how are we going to do that?
It will be broadcast live. And you can also go back and listen to the archives after we are all done. So we'd love for you to join us here in Mount Vernon. But if you can't be with us, then tune in. And that's certainly been a well-received event.
Yes,
over the last few years. Do throw this out, March 11th for the ladies at the Carriage Oaks Church of Christ in Bossier City, Louisiana, a Bible class teaching workshop. This is hosted by T. McCorder and April Meacham, and that begins at 9 a.m. to 3 p.m., and you can contact, once again, the Carriage Oaks Church of Christ in Bossier City, Louisiana.
All right. Lots of stuff coming up. I know we've got events in March and April already being announced. I know they were talking the other day in our meeting about our gospel meeting coming up in April. Kerry Clark's coming to preach here for that particular event. And I was like, wow, it's not even February yet. Well, tomorrow's February, so we're advancing really quickly. Mm-hmm. So as the days draw near and the March events, the April events, we'll tell you more about that.
That's right. Plenty to keep your calendar full. But let's go ahead and jump into our text for this morning. We've got four good chapters, a lot of good lessons there throughout. And once again, we'll be in Exodus chapter 1 through 4. And I think back in just timeline-wise, we find ourselves probably about 1450 B.C. A little debate there as you go back to these older dates are some difficulty to pin down to any exactness, but we're around that 1400, 1450 years now since we have gone through the book of Genesis. And that, you know, sometimes I forget. You go through that book of Genesis, and there's a lot that happens, but you stop and think you're covering some 2,500 years in the course of Genesis from the creation of Adam and Eve to Joseph bringing his family down into Egypt. Mm-hmm. And so you've covered a huge section of history, mm-hmm. and we have just barely touched on even the history of the world there. Mm-hmm. But we've been focusing in on now this one family. And the book of Exodus shows us now how that one family has been able to grow into the multitude that God had promised.
And to the point that you mentioned, if I'm not mistaken, I think I read this in one of the commentaries recently, that as the thousands of years that are there, or the great span of time that you see in Genesis, Exodus covers just a very short period of time. It's kind of strange to go from something of that vast nature into something that happens just over a couple of years. It's kind of interesting the way that it's laid out by Moses.
And, you know, we cover, to some degree, you have the birth of Moses, then you skip forward. But here in these first four chapters, we're going to cover 80 years. But then all of a sudden, you slow down and you're, you know, matter of weeks, maybe months there as this actual deliverance is going to occur. Mm-hmm. And so, once again, there's a great pause really throughout the rest of the Pentateuch in a way, as you have had such great amounts of time span. All of a sudden, we kind of slow down, focus on these few years, the establishment of this nation, and then we speed back up a little. And so different times, and it just reminds us God wants us to have details of certain things.
That's right.
And he's recorded that for us. Mm-hmm. It's amazing to me, again, we stop and think about what we have before us. And let's just look at the first seven verses here. And we're going to see what I titled God's Plan.
All right. These are the names of the children of Israel which came into Egypt. Every man and his household came with Jacob: Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, and Benjamin, Dan, and Naphtali, Gad, and Asher, and all the souls came out of the loins of Jacob were 70 souls, for Joseph was in Egypt already. And Joseph died, and all his brethren, and all that generation. And the children of Israel were fruitful and increased abundantly and multiplied and waxed exceedingly mighty, and the land was filled with them.
Okay. Now, we think in these seven verses, in many ways, we have a span of 400 or more years, the time that they're actually spending here in Egypt. As now they have traveled down there, we have that note, we have the reminder. Really, this just serves as that connector between the end of Genesis to the events that we're going to lead up to in the book of Exodus. You have that reminder that this is the count of those who have gone down into Egypt. Here listed as 70. You take into account there, even with the family of Joseph, he and his wife, his kids are there. So you have a family starting of about 75. Mm-hmm. Now, others will mention as well, we know earlier that this has been a large family in terms of their possessions, possibly even their servants that have traveled down there with him too. We don't have that count of everyone that was there. But again, in the family, you have this count of about 75 that are now in Egypt and are going to grow and flourish. Mm-hmm. If we take a peek forward, and this really is going to key in on verse 7, but you take a look forward to Numbers chapter 2 and verse 32, when this nation is going to be called out, and they have this numbering of the males above the age of 20 that were able to go forth to war. And you have 603,550.
Mm.
That is already a large number just of fighting men.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you think those men likely married. Those men have mothers and fathers. Those men have maybe children of their own. Conservatively, you easily reach 1 or 2 million
sure,
people.
Absolutely.
And when you consider the larger families of that time, it may well have even surpassed that.
Yeah.
But 75 to now, we'll say, I believe on a low scale, maybe 2 million people.
Yeah.
And maybe quite possibly even more than that. And so consider those words of verse 7 again. Mm-hmm. They were fruitful.
Yep.
They increased abundantly. They multiplied, they waxed exceedingly mighty, mm-hmm. and the land was filled with them. I mean, this has been God's promise all along. If we go back even into to Genesis chapter 12, and you have that original promise, this is what God has told Abraham, that I am going to bless thee. And so Genesis 12, verse 1 through 3, the Lord had said unto Abram, get thee out of thy country, from thy kindred, from thy father's house, unto a land I will show thee. I will make thee a great nation. I will bless thee. I will make thy name great, and thou shalt be a blessing. I will bless them that bless thee, and curse him that curseth thee. And all the families, and in thee all the families of the earth shall be blessed. We're specifically dealing there in verse 7, I believe. You're looking at that second promise, mm-hmm. that nation promise. Mm-hmm. You were a family, but in the shelter of Egypt, you have been able to flourish and grow. Mm-hmm. And this is an important time in this history because God in his wisdom and in his power has provided a place that has made this possible. Mm-hmm. He could not have just given those 75 people all of the land of Canaan right. and been able to be a nation that was controlling that whole land area. But they've been able to have this little section of Goshen here, this area kind of north and east of Egypt, and there they have been able to flourish and to grow. And so God, in his plan, mm-hmm. has grown to this great nation.
I saw earlier where, I believe it was in the World Video Bible School notes, that they suggested that the idea here in the Hebrew about the land was filled with them, mm-hmm. maybe more literally translated something like swarmed mm-hmm. with them. And if you've ever been swarmed by some bees, or if you've ever, get your head around that idea, the land, as we go forward and you look at this problem in Pharaoh's mind, think again about the swarming mm-hmm. of this Hebrew people. So I like the way that they pointed that out. I haven't personally looked that up, but I like that idea, swarmed the mm-hmm. land.
Mm-hmm. You know, again, I'll note my shortcoming here because I didn't necessarily have that thought before now, but I wonder comparatively the land mass of Egypt and how it would compare, probably smaller than Texas, if I had to guess.
Yeah, it could be.
And, if we turned around, and I know there's a lot of immigration debate and things going on right now, but imagine if we turned around and all of a sudden woke up to the idea there are 2 million plus of a certain population. Mm-hmm. Now, whether there is a threat of terror there or not, you're just simply looking at a people and say, they're going to grow more powerful than we are. Mm-hmm. They're going to have more control. They're going to have the potential. Maybe they want to rise up. Maybe they want to take control and leadership. There's going to be a little bit of a fear there, in their response here that we're going to see. And so, simply note first their great growth, and so that's God's plan. Mm-hmm. That's what He had designed for to happen. But then I also consider maybe God's protection. And especially as we go forward, we're not going to be able to read all of this. But we look particularly in verse 8 through verse 14, you're going to see that God is still going to be with his people. Mm-hmm. And Chip, I believe you had Genesis 39, Joseph in Potiphar's house.
Yeah.
That idea, that phrase that was continually repeated through there, and God was with Joseph. Mm-hmm. And as we look at these people, we're going to be reminded God was with his people.
That's right.
Even though we begin now to read of an oppression, even though there's going to be greater difficulty arising for the people, God is still going to be with them.
That's right.
Let's look and consider. I wish we could read all four of these chapters, but let's look at verse 8 and 9 to begin with. We see the fear in Exodus chapter 1, if you have that for us.
Absolutely. Now there rose up a new king over Egypt, which knew not Joseph, and he said unto his people, behold, the people of the children of Israel are more and mightier than we.
And then jump down and let's grab verse 13 and 14 and their plan there.
And the Egyptians made the children of Israel to serve with rigor, and they made their lives bitter with hard bondage in mortar and in brick and in all manner of service in the field. All their service, wherein they made them serve, was with rigor.
All right. And so now you have, back in Genesis, you have the family of Joseph welcomed with open arms. Mm-hmm. They are greeted well. They are treated well. They are set apart into their own place. But a great change has come. Verse 8 notes that for us, that there was now a new king that knew not Joseph. Now, that can express a number of ideas. It could be you've had the passage of time, and this memory of what Joseph has done has waned. It's no longer an important national event. He's no longer looked back on as the one that saved Egypt and his people. It's potential there. One has arose that simply no longer cares, could be expressed there. That he no longer appreciates, no longer feels the need to show this favor to Joseph's family. There's also an interesting concept that has always appealed to me, and I know, again, there's some hardship in lining up the pharaohs, but there is a potential idea this may be a whole new dynasty that has come into power. And so you think about, even as we do, we don't necessarily have a change of dynasty in the same effect, but every 4 years we swear in a new president who has the potential to come in and basically replace all of the top-level heads of government. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm not going to necessarily honor the contracts and things that are set in place. We're going to overturn those things. And I think you can have a similar idea here. Of one, if you have a whole new ruling family that has come in, or a whole new class that is now going to rule, there may not be a recognition of what has gone before. Mm-hmm. That history will not mean the same.
You know, I thought of Exodus chapter 5 and verse 2, where this Pharaoh says, "Who is the Lord that I should obey his voice to let Israel go?" There's no recognition of the deity of the creator of the universe here. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't help but think that, you know, whether we're talking about dynasties or recognition of one Joseph, that's where we are. He doesn't recognize the authority that Joseph had. He didn't recognize the influence that he had. And maybe to the point, you know, that you mentioned, maybe he just didn't know who the guy was or the benefits that he was to the country. But anyway, here's the same type of an idea, I think.
Right.
Even as there's no recognition with the creator of the universe.
Right. And you go back to Joseph. Joseph had made it clear, I can't tell you what your dream means, but the God in heaven can.
That's right.
And so with a loss of knowledge or respect of Joseph, also the God of Joseph. And we'll certainly see that there. And so what I really want to impress upon us in those sections is, as he says, let us deal wisely with them. We're afraid they're going to multiply. Well, we skipped over verse 12, but as they afflicted them, they the more grew and multiplied. And now, so we're afraid of this people. They're a large number of people. They're a great group. Let's oppress them. And yet the more we put pressure on them, the larger they grow. And so it is made mention now they're going to put them under bondage. They're going to serve with great rigor. And so already a back-breaking labor as the Egyptians are going to put them to work.
Yeah.
And yet what I'm impressed or reminded, even as we looked upon there, this was not a surprise to God.
Oh, no.
Go back again to those promises of God, even to Abraham. And fast forward now to Genesis chapter 15. And there in verse 13, God had told him, he said, "Know of a surety that thy seed shall be a stranger in a land that is not theirs, and shall serve them, and they shall afflict them 400 years. And also that nation whom they serve will I judge, and afterward shall they come out with great substance. And they and thou shalt go to thy fathers in peace. Thou shalt be buried in a good old age, but in the fourth generation they shall come hither again, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet full."
There it is.
God knew these things were going to come to pass. And he warned Abraham, yes, your people are going to go down into that land in which they'll be a stranger. Yes, they're going to be afflicted there, but I will call them forth. And maybe I'm making a leap. I think we can learn something there as Christians about patience and long-suffering. And my mind even went to Revelation 2 and verse 10. Mm-hmm. You're going to endure suffering. You will endure affliction for 10 days, some period of time there. But be thou faithful unto death, mm-hmm. and I'll give thee a crown of life. Mm-hmm. God was not indifferent to his people's suffering. God was not overlooking that suffering. Here, this was going to be a part of that thorn, if you will, that the people are going to go great. They are going to be oppressed, but God's going to ensure not only are these people going to let you go, they're going to let you go with favor. They're going to want you to leave, and they're going to bestow upon you even blessings as you go. They can't see that yet. Mm-hmm. But that, again, is within the within the hand of God. Mm-hmm. We have great promises unto us as well. We have a great home that we're looking forward to. We have the abundance of promises that God has given us as his children. But he doesn't say it's always going to be easy and smooth sailing.
No.
There's going to be difficulty. But continue faithful. Endure through those hardships and look forward to the reward that is going to come. Mm. I'll throw this out there again. I'm not an Egyptologist to throw that out. I've heard different pharaohs as a potential. Some have said this pharaoh that begins to increase the oppression was, I can't probably even pronounce this name, but Thothm, that T-H doesn't belong at the beginning of a word.
Ptolemy?
Ptolemy. That sounds better than what I was trying to get out. Ptolemy the Third. And would place us about Amenhotep II, potentially there, the pharaoh on the throne at the time of the actual Exodus. Mm. And so now they're facing this oppression, they're facing that hard labor, even working with rigor. But if you can underline something, that put an idea there, God continues to bless his people.
That's right.
And continues to allow them to grow even as their work increases.
Yeah.
And so we've had God's plan, this family growing into a nation in Egypt. We've had his protection. As you think about here, he's watching over them. He's still with his people, even during that oppression. Now let's consider, if you will, God's providence over the rest of chapter 1 into chapter 2, because now we're going to begin to see how God is going to hear his people and set about to deliver them.
Mm-hmm.
We know likely, if you have studied the Exodus at all, you remember, of course, that to stop, to curb their growth, he calls to the midwives, and he's going to say, when the children of Israel bear children, if it's a daughter, let her live. If it's a son, you're going to kill the son. Mm. And this, again, was an attempt at population control. And yet those midwives are going to look back. He's going to be mad with them. Why have you saved these men? About verse 18, verse 19, they're going to respond, well, these Hebrew women are so sturdy, if you will. They are lively. They've delivered before we even get in unto them.
Mm-hmm.
And so once again, he is going to charge all the people, verse 22, that if a son is born, you're going to cast that son into the river, and a daughter you shall save alive. That's the level of oppression we've reached by the end of chapter 1.
Yeah.
Now, what I can appreciate, and again, we can't know all of the details of exactly everything that was happening, but you have the midwives there that were more concerned with God than man, and cared more for the opinion and command of God than they did of Pharaoh. I can't help but think in my mind there to examples that we will revere even as you go into the New Testament. Mm-hmm. And Acts chapter 4 and verse 19 and 20, you have that idea where the apostles are being told not to preach anymore in the name of Jesus. And Peter and John will rightly respond, whether it's right in the sight of God to hearken unto you more than God, judge ye. Mm-hmm. For we cannot but speak the things that we have seen and heard. You can make it illegal. You can tell us not to do this, but we can't hold back. We're going to tell people about God and about what he has done. And so he cared more for the favor of God than the favor of men. And in Acts 5 and verse 29, Peter and the other apostles will cry out, we ought to obey God rather than man.
Mm-hmm.
And we live in a nation where many things are legal. May even come a time when doing that which is right is illegal. And yet we ought to have that same reverence for God and his word as we see in Acts 4 and 5 and as we see in these midwives that we read about here at the end of Exodus chapter 1.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the same thing I see, I was just trying to find it real quickly in chapter number 5, the argument that comes up at the end of the chapter, you know, if this is of God, you can't overthrow it, verse 39. But if it's not of God, you know, it's going to fall. And, mm-hmm. You know, Pharaoh, whatever he does, it's not going to work. And certainly we see that into the plagues, you know.
Mm. And so that's the conditions that exist as we enter into chapter 2. You're going to read, they're not identified for us here, but of Moses' parents. Mm-hmm. They're going to have the birth of a son, and we later will learn their names as Amram and Jochebed, identified in Exodus chapter 6 and verse 20. And they also are helping to lay the foundation for this deliverer.
Mm-hmm.
For they have the birth of a son, consider him a goodly child. We're told in Acts chapter 7 and verse 20 that they would be they would nourish him in their own house for 3 months. So again, rebelling against the command of Pharaoh. Also, Hebrews 11 and verse 23 identify for us there that 3 months that he is going to be kept in the house with the parents. But no, eventually, we can't keep this up.
Mm-hmm.
We have to do something, and we will not listen to Pharaoh and kill our son, but do design a plan whereby they will place him in a reed basket, put him down near where Pharaoh's daughter will come to bathe, the daughter of Amram and Jochebed.
Miriam,
thank you.
Right,
drew
right.
a blank there. is going to stay and watch over. And even will be instrumental now in coming to Pharaoh's daughter and saying, I can find a Hebrew woman to take care of that child mm-hmm. for you and fetch his own mother. And so by a turn of event there, Moses is going to be taken into Pharaoh's house. What's important there is Acts chapter 7 and verse 22, where Stephen in this history is going to record that Moses was learned in all the wisdom of the Egyptians and was mighty in words and deeds. Mm. And Moses would grow up and try to help his people. We're covering a lot of history and a lot of text there, but just to summarize, Moses has grown up in that household at the age of 40. Acts chapter 7 and verse 23, he will go out, he will see an Egyptian that is arguing with a Hebrew, and Moses seems to think, he seems to know something of how he could be instrumental in helping, and wonders, maybe even I am the one that could help to deliver God's people. Acts chapter 7 and verse 24, again, this is Stephen's history recounting. He said, seeing one of them suffer wrong, one of his own people suffer wrong, he defended him, avenged him that was oppressed, and smote the Egyptian, for he supposed his brethren would have understood how that God by his hand would deliver them, but they understood not. I think Moses has an idea here. Maybe I've been put in this position to be the deliverer of God's people. Instead, it largely backfires on him in Exodus chapter 2, verse 11 through 22. And he is going to flee to Midian to save his life. Now, I want to look at that, and again, somewhat in summary, but note two lessons that came to my mind concerning God's timing and God's care. You know, it's amazing to me as I think about, I have no doubt there were children of Israel that had begun praying to God when you have a Pharaoh that comes on that knows not Joseph. Mm-hmm. And this oppression has increased, and maybe they're beginning to pray, beginning to call out to God. And they're suffering through these years of oppression and work. Well, that begins even before the birth of Moses. Moses is going to be reared in Pharaoh's household for 40 years. He's going to spend another 40 years in the wilderness tending to his father-in-law's herds. It's going to be 80 before he returns to Egypt to deliver God's people. That's a lot of time in the eyes of a lot of people, over 80 years there from the beginning of the oppression till God is going to bring them out. There might be someone that says, God doesn't hear. God doesn't care. They were wondering, are these prayers being efficient? And what's amazing in my mind, once again, is in reality, God was at work. God was already laboring to bring about a deliverer. God already was raising up Moses. They're not going to see that care for over 80 years. Mm-hmm. And so just because we cry out to God, just because we have a petition and we don't see an immediate answer, doesn't mean that God doesn't care. It doesn't mean that he's not watchful. I think of 1 Peter 5 and verse 7, that God cares for us. He knows our affliction. As well, I think there of 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 12, a great reminder that the eyes of the Lord are over the righteous,
right,
and his ears are open unto their prayers, but the face of the Lord is against them that do evil. It was that reminder. Yes, God cares for you, and even today he calls on us there, that 1 Peter 5, 7, cast all your care upon him, for he cares for you.
Mm-hmm.
And then again, I would remind us of timing. Moses, again, seems to have known something about his heritage, about the idea that God is going to send a deliverer, and it might just be me. But he's going to have to learn that's going to happen on God's time and not his own.
Mm-hmm.
Perchance, that's what Moses is thinking when he sees an Egyptian dealing harshly with a Hebrew. I have an opportunity to do something. I can rise up. I can be a leader of my people. I can be the force whereby they're going to be delivered. I appreciate and commend his desire to want to help, mm-hmm. but it's not going to be accomplished in his way or in his time. Again, of interest to me on that, Hebrews 11, as we think about Moses, and a remark that's made about him in Hebrews 11, verse 24 and 25. By faith, Moses, when he was come to years, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a season. Now, I don't know that we oftentimes try to attribute that to a particular point in his life, but I would suggest to you that that best fits this time in which he makes a decision, am I going to remain silent or am I going to help my people?
Mm-hmm.
And that's a decision that's going to cost him.
Mm-hmm.
When did he make the decision not to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter? Well, it had to have been here around that time,
mm-hmm.
that he says, I want to be identified with my people. I want to raise up and help them, and it's going to cost him his place in Pharaoh's home. It's going to cost him by leaving that place in fear. And I would suggest to you that's not just simply a decision of, I want to help one that's being oppressed. There's a lot of weight behind that decision.
Mm-hmm.
And Moses realizes there are choices I'm going to have to make. And ultimately, I'll suffer with the people of God. But what a great example of faith that is for us, that we would be like Moses. Let's choose rather even to endure affliction in this life with the people of God than to enjoy the pleasures we might have of this life and then miss that eternal reward.
Mm-hmm.
And so, again, I'm not specifically dealing with all of that text, but I think there's some great lessons there of the Hebrew midwives, of the parents of Moses, of Moses himself, mm-hmm. the people that are going to say, ultimately, I want to serve God. Mm-hmm. And that's going to lay that groundwork, even though we're not seeing it immediately come to pass. But God is using those choices, those decisions, and those people to lay the foundation that's going to ultimately deliver his people.
And keep your mind's eye right there as we progress on our text, because by the time we get into the next couple of chapters and he starts throwing out this resistance, I couldn't help but think about the lectureship coming up this weekend. Mm-hmm. Seems like God is seeking to rekindle the fire that is within Moses, mm-hmm. Because here we see a zealous, an encouraged, this enthusiastic individual as he, as you suggested, seems to want to take on the role of deliverer, mm-hmm. In the actions that we see. And then when it comes time to actually do the job some 40 years later, I'm not really a good speaker. Who do I tell them sent me? They're not going to believe me. All these things start to come up. So mm-hmm. keep your finger there as we go forward and just kind of think where he was and where he is now in the next couple of chapters.
There is certainly a great contrast there. And just to remind us, I would start those first seven verses, God's plan, grow that family into a great nation, God's protection, he's going to be with them, God's providence. Mm. He begins to deliver up a deliverer, even as we'd see later in the book of Judges, mm-hmm. And God's provision. That's how I'll wrap out chapters 3 and 4, mm. that now God is going to provide for this deliverer. Now it is God's time. Mm-hmm. He will hear, and he will deliver his people. Chip, if you don't mind, grab for us Exodus 2, verse 23 through 24.
2:23-24. It came to pass in the process of time that the king of Egypt died, and the children of Israel sighed by reason of the bondage, and they cried, and their cry came up unto God by reason of the bondage. And God heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob.
And even there, verse 25, God's going to look on them and have respect unto them. God's going to hear that prayer, mm-hmm. And is going to deliver his people. And I find that wording, again, interesting. These things are brought to mind by the prayers of God's people. But he was not unattentive to them.
Right. He didn't forget.
Right. In fact, you look at that, he's already been doing something about this.
Yep.
And so I would suggest to us, here is a place in which we are reminded of the prayers of the righteous being mm-hmm. effectual. Mm-hmm. God was at work, but their prayers are going to, accommodatively speaking, keep this at the forefront of God's mind. Mm-hmm. Their prayers are effective in bringing this about, but God was already working in the background to accomplish it. And so certainly he had not forgotten his promise. He had not forgotten his people. And now what we have is simply the plan going into effect to bring about this deliverance. Mm-hmm. And so Moses is now perfectly groomed. He doesn't realize it, but he is now perfectly groomed to be the deliverer of God's people. We oftentimes note, and I believe it's important, three stages of Moses' life. He lived to be 120 years old. He spent the first third of his life in Pharaoh's household, age 0 to 40. Roughly the next 40 years there, 40 to 80, are going to spend in the wilderness of Midian. And think about, what does he need? He needs the learning of a leader. It's that in Egypt. And he needs the learning of a guide, basically. And he gets that in the wilderness of Midian. Hmm. You know, he's tending his father's sheep. Here's a man that now is going to have a greater understanding of what can the land do? Where can I find water? Where can I find food? Where can I find shelter? Where are places that we can go? I believe that's an important point of his life as well, to learn what he's going to need to lead a nation in a wilderness. And the next 40 years of his life, from 80 to 120, he's going to be leading the people of God in the wilderness, mm-hmm. Before he eventually dies there on the border of the promised land, not able to enter in. But I couldn't help but there think of Galatians 4 and verse 4.
Oh, yeah.
God, in the fullness of time, when things were right, it wasn't 40 years ago when Moses tried to rise up with a mighty hand and deliver his people. It's now that he has been humbled. It's now that he has been properly prepared. It's now that the wickedness of the Amorites is full. Again, this is all in God's timing. When is it right to take this nation out of Egypt? When is it right to deliver them into the land of Canaan? Well, in the fullness of time, when God knows that it's right. Mm-hmm. I know that Galatians 4:4 deals with the Christ, but it's that same idea. Christ came at just exactly the right time in history when it was prepared. And God's people are going to find that throughout time. I mean, you have even Abraham and Sarah, and we talked about them, and they tried to, if you will, force God's hand. Well, you have the birth of Ishmael with Hagar there because they weren't patiently waiting on God's time. Mm-hmm. And now Moses is prepared, and he's ready, and he is going to come back and call Moses. I've thought a lot of Moses, and I've wondered. There seems to be times of people's lives in which there are important lessons. Mm-hmm. And I think this 40 years, the second 40 years of Moses' life, is part of God's plan that Moses is going to come back as a leader, but he's also humbled. Because we're going to read Numbers chapter 12 and verse 3 that Moses was meek above all of the men which were upon the face of the earth. You see, 40 years ago, Moses wanted to deliver God's people by his strength, mm-hmm. by his power. Now, as he goes back to Pharaoh, Moses in many ways is, I don't want to describe him as a broken man, but he has certainly been harnessed, if you will.
Yeah.
Because he's going to come back with power and with strength, but ultimately it's going to be the strength of God. Mm-hmm. No one's going to question who delivered the people of God. Well, it was God by the hand of Moses. It wasn't Moses doing this by himself. And so, again, I believe a vitally important part of Moses' life, really we don't have much detail on, but it was important. Hmm. And so now God is going to call Moses to his task, beginning here in verse 2 of chapter 3. You have Moses in verse 1 tending to the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law. He is out as a shepherd, and verse 2 tells us that the angel of the Lord appeared unto him in a flame of fire out of the midst of a bush, and he looked, and behold, the bush was burned without fire, or with fire, and the bush was not consumed. Mm. He recognizes there is a sight. Mm-hmm. This is not natural.
Yeah.
There is something special that is going on. And as he will approach this bush, again, chapter 3 is not one to skim over, but Chip, maybe grab for us verse 5 and 6.
And he said, "Draw not nigh hither. Put off thy shoes from off thy feet, for the place whereon thou standest is holy ground. Moreover, he said, I am the God of thy father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob." And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look upon God. Mm.
What we're going to be reminded here, and Moses is going to be impressed upon, is that here, this burning bush that has caught his attention, that he has been drawn to now to see what is going on, it's out of that great bush that the great I Am is going to speak to Moses. And it's going to be impressed upon him, you are in the sight or the presence of deity.
Mm-hmm.
Moses, there is a reverence, there is an honor here. Don't take this lightly. You are before the very presence of God. Mm-hmm. Take off your shoes. Approach this as a hallowed place. And that's going to be important even as we fast forward. Moses is going to be in charge of the construction of the temple, mm-hmm. Not the temple, but the tabernacle, that great right. place of worship. Moses, there is a reverence that you're going to need in dealing with these things. You're dealing with the things of God, and I believe that begins right here in chapter 3 by understanding what a... we've destroyed this word, but what an awesome deal this is for Moses to be here. Again, we throw that word around, I think, in today's society, everything is awesome, but in the full sense of the word, this is a place of awe, of reverence and respect.
And we have trouble with that today, brother. I mean, everywhere you go, I live next to the funeral home, and so I see a lot of people coming and going. I know you work there. Have you ever noticed that people put on some incredibly fancy duds to go into a funeral home, and then they wear their casual wear into the worship of the creator of the universe? I think there's a correlation here between this idea of you recognize where you are and who you are serving and who you are facing. I don't really get that mentality, you know, this casual approach that folks have, even unbeknownst to them. It's something that they don't often think about, I don't think. But I think as we had the responsibility to teach the whole counsel of God, we should at least look at this idea of how we come before the creator of the universe, you know, the master of all that we see and know. We have that responsibility. Right. And there was a day and time when I remember words like, put on your Sunday going to meeting clothes. You know, and I don't know that we haven't lost that somewhere.
You know, I was thinking, as you, even as you were saying that, maybe we've developed the idea too much that the building is not the church. That's true. But we need to remember that when we come together as the church, we're entering before the throne of God. We are bringing our worship before Him. There was certainly a reverence that was expected of Moses, and no less for us today. So great point that you have brought out there. And during the course of this conversation, Moses is going to be given a task. Let's jump down to verse 9 and 10 and see what God wants Moses to do.
Now, therefore, behold, the cry of the children of Israel has come up unto me, and I have also seen the oppression wherewith the Egyptians oppressed them. Come now, therefore, and I will send thee unto Pharaoh, that thou mayest bring forth my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt.
Okay, Moses, this is your call. I have come and appeared to you because I have heard the cry of my people, and I want you to go to Pharaoh and tell him, as we have boiled it down, let my people go. You go and you bring out my people. And what I want to deal with in the remainder of our time, now that Moses understands what God wants, there's about four excuses that he's going to lay out here. First off, in chapter 3 and verse 11, Moses said unto God, who am I that I should go unto Pharaoh, that I should bring forth the children of Israel out of Egypt? Who am I? Chip, go ahead, if you will, read for us there verse 12. This is going to be God's response back.
He said, certainly I will be with thee, and this shall be a token unto thee that I have sent thee. When thou hast brought forth the people of Egypt, ye shall serve God upon this mountain.
There's a sense in which I think God looks back at Moses and says, who are you? You're the servant of God. That's who you are. You're going in my full power and my authority to do this work. This sign, one day you're going to be successful. You are going to do this. You're going to come forth. You're going to worship here. And you're going to know that I am God. And so who are you? You are the servant of God. You know, we as children of God today might make note of that. Who am I? You're the child of God. Who am I? Someone will ask maybe in the world, who am I to be a Christian? Who am I? I don't deserve this. You have the potential to be the son of God. That's who you are. You're the one that was made in his image. You're the one that he has great things designed for you, but he calls you unto obedience. And so he is the author of eternal salvation unto those that obey him. Hebrews 5:8, I believe, if I'm going off the top of my head there. But we need to be reminded, even as Moses needed to be reminded, as he asked that question first and foremost, who am I?
And I saw there, even as the translators added the word am, I looked at that and I wondered if it couldn't be seen. Who, me? You know, who else is standing there? Yeah, you. You're the one that's going to go. You're the one that has been chosen to go. Matthew 28, Mark 16, go. Who, me? Me? Who am I?
Right. I think there of the title of Ivan Stewart's book on personal evangelism, Go Ye.
Yep.
Means go me.
That's right.
Means go you. Go into all the world. Who are we? Yes, you're the servant of God. Number two, Chip, would you read for us there verse 13? This might be a second excuse here.
Number 13, Moses said unto God, Behold, when I come unto the children of Israel and say unto them, The God of your fathers has sent me unto you, and they shall say unto me, What is his name? What shall I say unto them?
You know, I title this one, The Idea of the Second Excuse. First one there, who am I? Second one is, who are you?
Right. I like that.
What am I going to tell the people? A burning bush sent me to deliver you. You go and you tell them essentially the great I am, the God of your fathers. He is the one that has sent me. Verse 14, God said to Moses, I am that I am. I am the great I am. The self-existent and eternal one, the one that always was, the one that always will be. I am the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. He's the one that has sent me unto you, verse 14 and verse 15 there. The one that has brought you to this place, the one who has given promises that you're going back to the land of Pharaoh. The land of Canaan.
Right.
And so I am the one that has sent you. And he goes on here in even greater detail, again, maybe to try to summarize some of that, but God's going to warn Moses, even Pharaoh's not going to hear you, but I'm going to show my glory through you so that both Pharaoh and Egypt and Israel will know who I am. I'm going to prove my glory to them. Let's drop down there to verse 19 and 20, where he says, I am sure that the king of Egypt will not let you go, no, not by a mighty hand. And I will stretch out my hand and smite Egypt with all my wonders, which I will do in the midst thereof, and afterward he will let you go.
Better believe it.
Someone said one time of the idea, God told Moses to go tell Pharaoh, let my people go. If he says, okay, the people were going to go out. If he says, no, the people were going to go out. God was going to show here who was in power, who was in control. And not only that, you're not going to go out empty-handed. The people of Egypt for which you have worked, you've labored in this hard, back-breaking labor, they're going to reward you. They're not only going to ask that you leave, they're going to expect that you leave, and they're going to give their possessions unto you. And that's exactly what we will find in the time of the Exodus. They are so ready for the people to go because of the plagues that have come upon them that they will even, as it were, pay them. Number three, the people won't hear me. Let's find this in Exodus chapter 4 and verse 1.
Moses answered and said, But behold, they will not believe me, nor hearken unto my voice, for they will say, The Lord hath not appeared unto thee.
The people will not hear me. That's excuse number three. What a great lesson. Verse two, what's in your hand? Many have built a good sermon off of that question. What is in your hand?
Right.
God could and would use him with what he had. And he would equip him in his task. Moses, you have what you need. You go, and I will show you as my leader. Some degree there, I couldn't help but think of a trio of verses, Ephesians chapter 6. Put on the whole armor of God. Has God not equipped you for the purposes that he sent you out?
Preach, brother.
God has provided for his people. 1 Timothy 3, verse 16 and 17, as it deals with that inspired word of God, to what end? That the man of God may be perfect, throughly furnished unto every good work. What has he not equipped his people for? What has he asked of us that he hasn't provided for, that he hasn't equipped us for? And then again, 2 Peter 1 and verse 3. that he has basically revealed to us all things that pertain unto life and godliness. What's he not given us? What has he not placed within our hands? Certainly, you can go to passages, Matthew chapter 25, deal with the talents. You could look at ideas of, you know, there are different people with different abilities, but you serve God with what you have.
Mm-hmm.
God was going to show Moses, even here, you have a staff in your hand, I can use that staff, drop it and it will become a serpent, grab it again and it will become your staff. I'll use those tools that you have and the people will know that I am God. And so Moses is basically saying, well, the people wouldn't listen to me anyway. You go.
Mm-hmm.
We can easily say that today. Well, the people don't want to hear. They won't listen to us. Go. Take the gospel. Let my word do that which it was designed to do.
In season, out of season.
Mm-hmm. And so go. And briefly here, number four, I'm not eloquent.
Right.
Chapter 4 and verse 10. I'm not eloquent, not here, not before. Well, I think Moses was selling himself short.
Mm-hmm.
You grew up in all the learning of Egypt. You are equipped. You are ready. Maybe there's things that you have forgotten, but I couldn't help there but think of Paul, Philippians 4 and verse 13. I can do all things through Christ that strengthens me. Moses needed to learn to rely on God and not in himself. Moses was going to be given the things that he would say. God would send him. And so we need to be willing to do our part, and God will do his.
Right.
And then I usually think of four excuses, but who am I? Who are you? The people won't hear me. I'm not eloquent. But even to a degree, chapter 4 and verse 13, he's essentially going to say, why don't you send somebody else?
Yeah.
I'm not your man.
Yep.
And God seems to me to grow a little impatient. And he says, basically, it's enough. I'm going to send you, but I'm also going to send with you Aaron, your older brother. And Aaron is going to be a mouthpiece unto you. Aaron's going to help you. Aaron's going to labor right along with you. And to this end, I couldn't help but think of Esther 4 and verse 14. Who knoweth? If thou art come to the kingdom for such a time as this, Moses, you've got a task before you. I placed you here for this end, for this purpose. Now go get to work.
Mm-hmm.
there are a lot of things we may not know in the providence of God, but we ought to take the advantage of the opportunities that are before us, for who knoweth if we are not come to the kingdom for such a time as this. Amen. Moses had a great task before him, but now it was time for him to go and do it. And I took up most of the time of those excuses there, but maybe something you want to add before we have to close, Chip?
No, you know, this whole idea of God's providence seen throughout the workings that we've seen through Joseph especially is just beginning to blossom here.
Mm-hmm.
And as you talked about his mouth and his ability, I would urge the listeners today, go back and read Deuteronomy and mm-hmm. tell me that he's not an eloquent speaker, mm-hmm. because this is a series of eloquent speeches,
mm-hmm.
And certainly he did sell himself short.
Right. I mean, again, you noted, look back and think about 40 years earlier. He was ready to take up a sword, basically,
mm-hmm.
And fight for his people, and now he's reluctant to go. But the thing is, now he was ready, mm-hmm. and now God was with him and on his side and telling him to go. It was time for him to get up and go to work.
Mm-hmm.
And God has sent us forward to work as well. We need to learn from the lessons here, even of Moses. So we will stop there for today. Our time is up, but we've set the stage for entering into, I believe, the first of the plagues, mm-hmm. Chip, tomorrow morning. And so I hope that you will be back with us as we're going to see his reception as Moses now goes and says, it's time for us to go.
And see idolatry defeated.
There we go. There we go. So we look forward to that. Hope you will join us right here on the Gospel Radio Network. And now we hope that you have a great day.
Listening to Mornings for the Master on the Gospel Radio Network. Remember to join us each weekday morning from 9 to 10 a.m. Central Standard Time, or catch the replay at 9 p.m. Central Time. You can also contact us at mornings@tgrn.org if you have any questions we can help you with, or if you have events you would like to submit to our bulletin board, or just with general feedback about the program or network. We would love to hear from you. As we've had opportunity to spend time with the Master this morning in His Word, let's remember His words in Luke 6:46, when He said, "Why call ye me Lord, Lord, and do not the things which I say?" He goes on to say in verse 47 and 48, "Whosoever cometh to me and heareth my sayings and doeth them, I will show to you whom he is like. He is like a man which built an house and digged deep and laid the foundation on a rock. And when the flood arose, the stream beat vehemently upon that house and could not shake it, for it was founded upon a rock." Let's show the wisdom of that builder and go now to live for the Master.